This episode of Pipeline Things, we go back to an esteemed guest who I think might be famous for their one-liners. You got to listen to the whole thing. Some of my favorite ones, buying research is stupid. Was that how I said it?
I think you said ridiculous.
Ridiculous. Some other really good ones, always put the pipeline first.
Yeah. Or I like this one. He said, you can't put pipelines in jail. Attorneys put people in jail.
Boom. It is a great episode. I think you're really going to enjoy it as we dive into a guest and talk about the Pipeline Defect Assessment Manual. Thanks for joining us on Pipeline Things. All right, welcome to this edition of Pipeline Things. It's so good to be back, and I am really excited about this series that we're going to be doing with you guys. And I don't want to spoil it yet because I think I need to set the stage with a brief conversation with my co-host before we introduce the guest.
Oh, we totally have to talk about the theme of the series, though.
Oh, do you want to give it away? Deliver the baby?
No, I don't want to deliver the baby. But sure. Like, you and I both have, if y'all have listened to this podcast at least a couple of seasons, you'll know that Rhett absolutely is fond of failure files. Like, he loves failure files. Right? He digs in and he tells a story. It's like story. I call it story time with Rhett. Right? It's so good. Mine was what I call the OG series because I love bringing on super cool people to the podcast and you guys getting to learn about them, meet them, and then potentially bump into them somewhere. And so for me, this is one of those where it's kind of like Sage Series 2.0 or like Original Gangsters 2.0. So I'm really excited about this series.
That is, you did deliver the baby. That's the baby, which is totally okay. You know, but part of the reason that I like this, right, is this concept. So for the audience, yes, this is a big part of our Sage or OG Part 2 series. Is I like connecting industry people with people that they might not have an opportunity to meet with. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason is that it's amazing to me how quickly things are forgotten, right? And so this is what I mean. Like, you know, Chris, I mean, we've been growing. We hired a couple of younger people, right?
Yeah.
Right? We were on the call the other day. I was actually spending time with one of them. And one of them, I told him, my wife is going to Waco, right? Now, Ms. Producer, when I say Waco, what's the first thing that comes to mind to you? This is a test.
That is not what I was going to go with.
When I say Waco, everybody, including our international audience in most cases, will say, Chip and Joanna Gaines. And they tell me that.
Farmhouse, baby, it's coming back.
Yep, close second is how usually we get Baylor University. And I'm like, fair, right? Growing up, if you'd have said Waco to me, that had a totally different meaning. I would have answered exactly what Sarah answered, which is David Koresh, Waco, right? And it's funny, so I was talking to one of the younger guys, and I was like, well, yeah, you know what happened to Waco? And he's like, you mean like the Magnolia Market? And I was like, wait, what? Do you not know the history? And I started probing. I was like, what do you else do you not know? I was like, Oklahoma City. And he's like, I think I remember something happened
there.
I'm like,
James Harden, Kevin Durant, and Westbrook were all on the same team. No one will remember that. That was like 10 years ago.
I was like, what about Ruby Ridge? I started asking all this stuff. And there was like, and finally I was like, please God, tell me. I know you were born after 9/11, but you did cover 9/11 in school, right? And he's like, yes, I did cover 9/11. But it's amazing to me, like, you can have these events that are significant, these stories that are significant. If they're not told, they get lost. And I was like, when we talk to these people that we're bringing on to Pipeline Things, it's, I think what I think about is that ability to tell the story, to keep that story, because we have those stories
now,
in the pipeline industry.
Do you realize that we are now beginning to fill that role where when we started, we would go to people for stories, and now we're the storytellers?
But do you feel like, I don't feel like our stories are as good. Like, mine aren't as good yet. That's for darn sure.
Yeah. So I think it depends. Maybe we don't storytell enough. Maybe that's it. We'll see.
I don't know. Well, but anyway, Ms. Producer, congratulations on being aware of what I would, Waco probably is not happy about it, but what I would still associate as the most important part of Waco. So without further ado, I think that that brings us in. I want to introduce our guest today. So Sarah's going on. I want to welcome Mr. Phil Hopkins. For those of you who have not had a chance to meet Phil, if you get a chance to hear Phil speak somewhere, you should take the opportunity.
Yes, register, get on a plane.
Yes.
Go hang out with Phil. And buy him a drink or two.
For sure. Clever, filled with wit. The first presentation that I saw him do, He talked about black swans and you never ever consider the integrity threat. And then he closed his presentation with this picture of a sloth turning the wheel of a valve. And I was like, it was so fabulous, like just all put together. And it left a mark on me for sure. So the chance to circle again. And I must say, Phil, before I let you speak, to our audience out there, several of you have asked me to bring on Phil, and I always tell you to give us feedback. Sometimes it takes 6 months to a year before I can actually, you might see the results, but Phil is definitely one of the results of that feedback that we got. So welcome, Phil. How are you today?
I'm feeling very well, and I'm looking forward to the day after. There's no swans, there's no monkeys. I'm on my own, except my cat.
Okay. Yeah. Well,
and depending how long this runs, maybe a cuckoo coming out of that clock.
I've got you like my clock, don't you? It's an Italian design. It is special. But it's only cuckoos on the hour, so we're safe for the next 55 minutes.
Man, 55 would be a long time on the podcast. It's tempting to try and do that. I don't think I can push it that long, though. Well, Phil, I'd like you to take a moment. I think it's safe to say that certainly on the U.S. side, I think many people have probably never had the chance to meet you or the benefit of hearing some of your background. Would you tell us a little bit about who you are, where you came from, and how you found your way into the pipeline industry?
Well, my name is Phil Hopkins. I'm an independent consultant for pipelines based in the UK. I worked for the pipeline company British Gas, then the consultants Andrew Palmer Associates, then the consultants Penn Spinner. For the past 11 years, I've had my own consultants there. So that's my very brief background. And I've spent a lifetime working with old pipelines, mainly North American and South American pipelines. So most of my work has been in the Americas. So if you have corrosion, dents, gouges, buckles, whatever in your pipeline, which you have, I'm the person to contact.
So how did you find your way? When did you start in the pipeline industry? And how did you find your way into the pipeline industry?
Oh, I started in the very late 70s. And that was the time, you say about forgetting memory. That was the time when we didn't have any tools, no computers. The best thing they had was a slide rule, FlexiCurve, and we were assessing defects in pipelines. And there was a lot of judgment. There was no publications, there was some very good research, certainly from Battalion America, very good, but it wasn't collated. So we were very much on our own, assessing the defects. And it was a lucrative position to be in because you were one of the few. Now there's many, and there's many documents. But in those days, there were no real documents. And we had to make judgments on many things, including pipelines, pressure vessels, pick traps, filters, you name it, they had problems. The only good thing was they were relatively modern. And the inspection wasn't that great. So they couldn't find cracks, for example. So we avoided assessing cracks because they couldn't find them. They were there, but they couldn't find them. So it was exciting.
Yeah, it sounds like a whole different time.
We were glad to get published.
A whole different time. You know, one thing you said that I realized people might not appreciate, British Gas. That is an entity, like there's a few, I call them mafias that exist in various places where lots
like
of people.
Era.
Yes, yeah. Like you alluded to one, Battelle. Battelle was a birthplace of a tremendous number of names in the pipeline industry. Yeah. But British Gas is no slouch. They introduced a lot of technology and formulations into the pipeline industry, probably more than most Americans even realize when we hear that name. So...
You know, Red, the strange thing then was that all organizations had their same research organizations. So Exxon, Chevron, Total, they all had big research groups. And I was in the research group and there was 3,000 of us, 3,000 people in research. So it was a great time to be a young engineer. Now there's not.
Because we don't need it anymore. We don't need to advance. We've moved past. Why do we need 3,000 researchers anymore? That's
well. The thing is, we've advanced in many areas like inspection, but we haven't advanced in assessment. We're still using methods based in the 1960s and 1970s.
That's valid.
On inspection methods that are 2026. There's a big, before it was, assessment was above inspection. Now it's the other way around. So we followed it backwards.
Question on personal preference, right? So you started back in the 70s and you see, it sounds like, you know, information was golden back then, right? That's what made you special. It's like, hey, call that guy. Yeah. He's awesome. But now we have a bunch of AI tools like Copilots where all this information is at typing a keyboard. Which era, if you had to do it all over again, would you be in if you had to do it all over again?
You know, surprisingly, I think now is very good. I like AI. It's a great help. It would make my job much easier. So I think now is good. But in the past, to learn quickly, certainly in the 70s, 80s, you had to learn very quickly. And also, then people shared things, information. So the guys at Battelle would send us all their reports, no argument. Here's all data, and we would send all our reports. Oh, Gas de France, send all the reports. Today, people are very protective. You have to buy them, first of all, which is ridiculous. having to buy research. I mean, that's crazy.
I'm going
to
write that. Buying research is ridiculous by Phil Hopkins.
Buy research is, well, we'll have some organizations in the US that'll get a little bit out of shape.
Just give it away. Just give it to people.
What happens when you give stuff away, Phil? I'm very curious about this. What do you think would happen if you just gave stuff away?
You get work. You admit, I think it's called Metcalfe's law. The more users who are aware of your work, the more work you get.
That's valid.
Based on electronics. So the more you give, the more you take. And that's a big lesson. We've given away so many things on training courses, free spreadsheets, free software, and the work comes back because people use it. And there's so many pipelines out there. There's so many thousands of human. It's very useful to give. And that's why I've always published everything I've had. I've published everything I know. I publish, and the work comes back.
So I'd bring it around, speaking about publishing and research, the reason we wanted to talk to you today, I think, is a document that's not well known enough in the United States. I will vouch, the first time I heard about it was probably 2012, 2013. It was at an operator, and he referenced the document and said, why don't we bring this up and use it more often? And that is, for our audience, the Pipeline Defect Assessment Manual, often abbreviated PDAM. If you've not heard of it, you're not alone. If you have heard of it, then you've probably utilized it. And the reason that we brought Phil on is Phil was instrumental in the development of that document. And so, Phil, if you don't mind, can you tell us a little bit about the origins of PDAM? And just so the audience knows, that document is very much still alive and well and accessible today. And we're going to talk about that throughout the episode. But Phil, where did PDAM come from? And can you give us a little bit about the genesis of that?
Well, let me take it back 30 years to 1997. And I was running a small office looking at old pipelines full of dents and corrosion and gouges and cracks and buckles.
For the record, I was in middle school, just so we're clear. I would have even known what a pipeline is. I like this.
They're all safe, but they're full of defects. I would emphasize that. What was curious was all the clients had the same problem. They were all queuing at the door. We've got corrosion, we've got gouges, we've got buckles, we've got dents. And great, we took the work on, and more clients came, same problems. And one of the problems you have with that sort of repeat work is, and you guys will know this, is that it's lateral development for staff. It's not vertical. It's been done. So what staff want is vertical or new work. The old work, it'll work. So what the staff said was, well, let's produce a manual with all the methods in, spreadsheets associated with the manual, and the client can do the work. It's very easy. It's all published. So three of our really good clients, which was National Grid in the UK, Total and BP, all put together $25,000 each. And we produced a manual called the Pipeline Assessment Manual, which contained a chapter on each defect. Could be laminations, could be spalling, could be corrosion. And all you did was open the chapter, and that gave you the equations, the methods to assess a defect. It was backed up by a thorough review, and it was backed up by a spreadsheet that could be used to the calculation. It was backed up by a database of any full-scale test that was proven in that equation. And they loved it. They thought it was great. And they said,
Wait, they being...
That's the method used.
The three. Now, I didn't know if it was the younger engineers or it was, because I want to get to this in a moment, because it's, just to recap, it's the three clients that were the original, like, participated in the development, but it was driven to some extent by your younger engineers who were like, we've already done this. Let's formulate it, if you will, proceduralize it and put it all together.
Yeah, we've got various rules for consultancy. I'm sure you guys have. One of the rules is we get interesting work for clever people.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. And we've got some very clever people, and repeat work is not interesting. It's quite boring. So when we came back and said, oh, another corrosion assessment, they dived under their desks. But if we came with something different, they jumped under the desk. And the second thing, the second rule we had was we put the pipeline first, the client second, and the consultant the third. So we felt we were being unfair to the client by just taking money off them. It was too easy. And then all those organizations had their own research organization. So they were interested as well. So the manual we produced, which is now, to call it a manual, is quite unfortunate. I think it's about 450 pages long.
Yeah, it's big.
The manual was very, very popular in those companies, and it was setting their procedures and methods. The question was, have you used PDAM to assess corrosion? So the likes of BP could go to a consultant and say, you will use this document to assess my corrosion. You use this document to assess my lamination. So in effect, it was a standard. It was a consensus document. So it was so popular that people started asking, can we have it? Well, it wasn't ours. It was a joint industry project then. And I think it was in the space of a couple of years, 16 companies, South America, Europe, America, joined. And they paid $25,000, and we produced a huge document called the Pipeline Defect Assessment Manual, PDAM. And that was first produced, I think, in 2003. And it had many chapters on corrosion cracks, anything, and loads of spreadsheets, loads of scientific reviews. And all those companies included it in their procedures. Now, one of your questions was, why wasn't it used in America? Well, first of all, it was the JIP. It was financial. The second thing was, I don't think it was fully appreciated that if ExxonMobil joined in Europe, their international membership, they can use it anywhere.
Yeah.
But instead, they used it in Europe. So Shell were used in Europe, Total, ExxonMobil, BP, but not much in America. And then, about that time, documents in America started to be produced. Yeah. That answered the question. But PDAM was the first manual that had all the information in it.
So I'm curious. Very impressive. So just to recap some of what you said and revisit it. This, you said originally the notion was your engineers were like, this is bored. They can do it themselves. And so you developed the set of procedures and the tools. How successful were you at were the clients at adopting it and using them themselves? Or did they tend to use it more like a procedure, which you described it also as going to a client and saying, hey, client X, follow this procedure, do the work for me?
It's the latter, right? They were confident with the review, and they were confident with the manual, and confident with the spreadsheets, so they were happy. But remember, then, they still had their own research organizations. They had some very clever people doing the work anyway. But what they wouldn't do is our work. They immediately came back to our door and said, you use it, we don't, we like it. And the office grew and grew and grew. So what we tried to achieve, we failed. The more we gave them, the more they came to us.
So you stopped hiring clever people is what you said, because the first rule was to get interesting work for clever people.
Yeah, we used it two ways. That's a good question.
Would you stop hiring clever people?
Always recruited clever people. But what we said was early starters, early career people, it's very good for lateral development.
For
and
sure.
Later people, the clever people, it was more vertical. So they went from indirect creative problem solving to logical step-by-step thinking. And that really challenged the staff, and we had a very low turnover because of that. So it was a good tactical move and very lucrative. It's really interesting. My CEO at the time, my boss, said to me, Phil, let me explain this. You're giving away all our equations in spreadsheet form, and you're giving training courses on how to do our work. I said, yes, what's wrong with that? He said, it'll kill us. All the time, we grew and grew and grew. So it goes against, we may not agree with what we did, but the evidence is that it grew and grew.
There's a problem with this episode now, which is it's exposing the secrets of consultants.
Yeah. So now everybody's going to go do it.
Yeah, now, because I get this, Phil, I get the same problem with my business partner, because people will ask me to do training and I do it for like next to nothing, sometimes nearly free, just because I enjoy it. And he's like, what are you doing? Chris is my business partner.
Oh, get out of here.
And you know, my co-host. And he's like, why didn't you charge him more?
No, I'm like, because I just get out of it. He's such a liar.
Chris, everybody that's listening to this episode knows it's true.
He's such a liar.
Everybody knows it's true.
We know. Oh, that's so much BS.
Even Miss Producer is back there laughing. Yeah, she's like, it's 100% true.
Because if you do a training course and there's 20 people there, you get, there are 20 users.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's exactly.
You never lose.
And I thought.
Training is better described as marketing. It's not training, it's marketing.
Phil's calling me out. I can't argue. He's actually 100% correct. Training is marketing.
This podcast is moving away from PDAM and its history into business consulting 101.
Consultants. They're really just...
I'm trying to do you guys help business. Yeah.
So what's...
I'll succeed.
What's funny about that, right, is I still get, I feel like the sentiments haven't changed, Phil, in 30 years. The problems definitely haven't changed, right? The same challenges exist, tents, buckles, wrinkles, cracks, corrosion. It's all the same. And I still get the same. Dents are a big one. Again, dents have come full circle with 192.712. And the number of people that have said, look, we want you to train us to do it internally. Bending strain is another really good one. People have asked me, I want to train you to do this internally. And I'm like, I can show you everything. I will sit down with you for hours. I will give you our software if you would like to purchase it so that you can do it. And I said, the problem is you won't want to invest the resources to sit and do bending strain on your own for hours on end. I was like, you won't. It's or you won't consuming. Get comfortable with wanting to take on the whatever, I guess, perceived risk or real risk of owning the assessment.
Well, that and having a dedicated resource on something, people say that they want to do it until they start doing it, and then you find they don't want to do it.
That's true.
Yeah. Because it's the monotony of what you said, right? I mean,
the
a lot of...
clients that I push, there's fewer and fewer workers in the clients, so I appreciate that. But it's always best for the client to do the work.
I agree.
I know your consultants and I will.
Oh, it's okay.
They've got all the information,
and
they've got all the responsibility. So
we
can do is offer.
We normally see it kind of two ways and not necessarily split down the middle. But, as a consultancy, they'll reach out to us and say, hey, we have this problem. Can you help us solve it? And so we'll solve it. We'll help them stand up a procedure. And then many times they do go away and they own that, right? So we help them tackle a new approach. But then there's the component of where I call it peak shaving or risk management, right? Where they may just have a workload that just comes in, it overwhelms their resources, and they need to delegate some of that out. Or two, it is more cost effective for them to sub it out because we're more efficient at it. But if we can, Phil, I want to bring us back just a wee bit to PDAM. I got a question for you. Here in the States, we often find that incidents are the catalyst for us to see change in how we do things. And when you said, 1997 to, early 2000s, one of the big things that came to my mind was Bellingham here in the States, which then led to a one-year sprint for ASME to make B31-8S. So within one year, they drafted and published the first version of ASME B31-8S, which was in 2001. Was there a similar drive? I mean, I don't think there was, but I wanted to ask, right? So, I mean, you said it was a JIP by proactive operators, but was there anything happening in that era that really drove it to go from 3 operators to call it 16 operators in that 97 to 2000, I think you said, 3 version? Or was it all people being proactive?
It was the latter. First of all, I was an expert witness on Bellingham, so I know it very well. And we were aware of the problem, and it was a great example. It was an example of where PDAM could have been used. And I think one of the people involved in Bellingham, he came on my course. So he had the tools to assess the defects. But
before the incident?
Yeah.
He was on your course before the incident?
Yeah.
Wow.
He applied correctly most of the information. But I think it's a fair question. At that time, the big change occurred in really the 70s and the 80s. In the 70s, the intelligent vehicle, the inspection tools start to be made. In the 80s, ASME B31G was brought out. So all of a sudden, inspection and corrosion became very famous. They could find it. We couldn't find it before. We didn't know about it. We had to dig a hole. It's a long hole for a pipeline. And so by the time the 90s came, all of a sudden, what had happened was they were finding the defects and they wanted to sort them out. And at the time, all the big operators and all the big companies like Shell, like Exxon, were losing staff. They were losing their research organization. So more and more work was coming out of these big companies and coming to the consultants, and it still does. So there was a change. There was a change in the market, and consultants became very powerful then. And to have a document that told consultants what to do throughout the company was a very useful thing to have. The reason it didn't take on in America was because things were changing. Documents were being made. Good documents. We'd already got very good documents in Europe. We had BS7910, which was a crack assessment document. Yeah. And you had then the old API 5009, same thing. But we had it. So in terms of defect assessment, we were very well set up to do the work. And also our friends at Patel and Southwest Research, they published everything. We had all the information. It was brilliant. And they came across and visited. They brought loads of manuals and research reports and said, here you are, Phil, a few more reports. Well, that was great. It's like $2 million of research we'll bring across. So very rich. So
oh, wait, on that note,
different market then.
Yep. Phil, I got to take a break real quick. Audience, when we come back, we're going to pick up the conversation around maybe why we don't see PDAM as much in the U.S. and also talk a little about the structure of the document, what's actually in there. And today, if you wanted to get access to it, how would you go about it? So hang on. We'll be right back on Pipeline Things. All right, welcome back to Pipeline Things. While we continue our conversation with our guest, Dr. Phil Hopkins. Is it doctor? Did I say that? Or no, is it just Phil Hopkins?
It's doctor, whatever you want to call it.
Oh, Phil. Okay. With Dr. Phil Hopkins and our discussion on the Pipeline Defect Assessment Manual. So just going back, you know, right before the break, Chris asked a question that I still think is interesting today. And that is, I get the sense that PDAM is, look, from my time working at Rosen and working with the lovely folks at Newcastle, there was a lot of familiarity within PennsPen and the remnants for sure of the Pipeline Defect Assessment Manual. But across the pond, there does not feel like there's the same level of awareness. And even so much, I mean, I asked Chris, I wish I had it at my fingertips. Whenever we talk to people about 318S and the development, which was happening around the same time, like, it almost like 318S could have grabbed large portions of PDAM. It didn't. Why do you think that's the case, Phil? Like, why do you feel like we have this we reinvented the wheel in the United States?
Well, I think it's different in the States. I mean, I've worked in the States for many years, and it's the regulatory framework. In Europe, we're very much goal setting. You know, build a safe pipeline and do not let it fail. That's the regulation. Whereas in America, it's very prescriptive. You shall. And the regulations often quote standards. For example, ASME or API standards.
Yeah.
Once you quote a standard, you've got to use it. There's no choice. In Europe, it's very goal setting. There's nothing quoted. So in France, in Germany, in Netherlands, or in the UK, you can use what you want as long as it's safe. The good thing is that if you set goal setting regulations, it's on you. It's as simple as that. It's on you. So you must be right. So the PDAM in Europe was really well set up. But in America, it wasn't quoted. So close. I've got to say that some of the documents you quoted are very good. API 1160, 1183, they're all good. So you were drip feeding into the regulations, the guidelines that PDAM was already quoting in Europe.
Yeah.
So it was slow because of a different market. Not so much different people, but just a different market.
So you mentioned, I think when I look at PDAM, you said earlier, like 400 pages. I can't remember. I think it has like...
It's more than 450.
20 or something sections. Yeah. It's a lot. It's got a lot of sections. What I'm curious about there is probably the closest equivalent, I would say, is 579. Mm-hmm. But this is like... Yeah. Whereas 579 is broadly fitness for service on anything and everything, including pipes and other equipment. PDAM's 450 pages focused on pipelines. Where do you think today, where do you think some of the best sections of PDAM are, or maybe some of the hidden gems for our audience?
Well, PDAM is a pipeline-specific document, pipeline. API 579 is chemical industry, and BS7910 is welding. But PDAM is the only one, as it says, is pipelines. So everything to do with it is pipelines, nothing but pipelines. And you know yourself that pipelines are quite special because they're thin pressurized shells. So you've got to put down exactly what it is. And also it's very much empirical based. So you need the test data. So PDAM presents all the test data. So if you want to do review, for example, dents, you get PDAM. It's got all the full-scale tests to run it again and produce a better model. Because PDAM is always developing. I think there's 49 sponsors now. So 49 times $25,000 is a lot of money. And all that money is put back into the manual to increase the numbers. I think a good example of the benefit of PDAM is, for example, the revision 2 of PDAM, which was in 2016, contained guidance on fatigue. So there's specific guidance on fatigue, which is becoming very topical. Also, PDAM covers offshore pipelines. offshore pipelines that are not very well covered by anybody in America. Nope. Now, DNV in Norway, great organization, great company. So all you need to do is start up with a couple of pages, rough guidance, even quoting standards and regulations. And so Peter really is looking at a pipeline only as a pipeline, whereas other documents necessarily have to be broader in perspective, like API to sell, as a result to other industries. But PTAM is not being sold. It's a sponsor say, we want more on fatigue in pipelines. Please give this chapter. So we research it, publish, and do it.
Which is really funny. Like two things I'm thinking of, like the cracking standard 1176. I don't remember when the first edition 1176 was published. Do you remember when that was? But I feel like it had to be generally around that time frame that the first edition of 1176 was. And now API is, again, they're discussing doing a specific pressure cycling standard. And I'm like, we could go and grab from PDAM and what's already there for sure. So it's just making me laugh because I feel like
it was circa 2016.
That's what I feel like.
I can't put my finger on it, but it was, that same it was time like frame. 14 to 16-ish. And again, everybody on the podcast, you guys don't remember. Yeah. But yeah, it's around there.
Leave a comment.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it is. Yeah, subscribe and leave a comment. You guys got the date of 1160 wrong.
So, Phil, I actually, this is more of a comment, but I'm curious about your reaction. You know, Rhett and I are often participating in the development of consensus standards here in the U.S., right? Whether it be ASME-based or API-based. And there's always such a significant component of the consequence of choosing certain words, or the consequence of putting a certain formula or approach or not putting an approach in these because of the regulatory environment that US-based operations are subject to. And you said something earlier around, you know, European is usually more goal-oriented, whereas US is more prescriptive-based. So kind of in that theme, I wonder... And I'm gonna ask a question. So, do you think that PDAM is a better technical document than American based technical documents because of the spirit of it and because of the fact that you guys are less controlled by regulation?
Well, I wouldn't say better. It certainly complements. I think 1183 is far bigger than the dense section in PDAM. You have to remember that, to be fair to the American operators, you've got 600 operators in America. I don't know, 600. Well, in Europe, you can fit them all in one room. You know, it's pretty simple.
This is the same thing Andy Drake said.
Yeah, Andy's about how they had to go across the whole spectrum of operators.
So in many ways, it's just different. It's just different. And I also like the American approach that the documents are very well written. Okay, you can't use them. They haven't got spreadsheets. They haven't got software free. But they're very well written. And because the standards, of course, they give you a choice. Say, here's five methods, choose one. Well, operators don't like that. They like a specification. You will use number one. Don't think. Whereas PDAM says use number one, simple as that. But it's just a different market. I think it's a shame that PDAM hasn't been used more.
Yeah,
because there are now 49 sponsors, which means it's been agreed by Shell, BP, Total, you know, all these big companies have sat on the committee and agreed to it. So we're wasting that. I would like to see it free and handed out, but...
Would you consider PDAM peer-reviewed?
Yeah.
All right, Phil, I'm going to go non-PDAM as we wrap up. I created a time machine, and you have the option to go back to late 1970s Phil Hopkins in the industry, maybe early 80s Phil Hopkins. What advice do you give the early version of your pipeline self? I might do this with all of our guests.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I'd always say never stop learning, whether you're 21 or 81 or 91, never stop learning. And there's so much out there. And the second thing I would say is always put the pipeline first. I know you shouldn't say that, but if you protect the pipeline, you protect the people.
Yeah, I love how you're going to say that.
And so I always think about the pipeline. I know it's a little bit against the grain, but I always think, what does the pipeline want? Because I think pipelines have got a bad name. And I will defend them. They'll say, pipeline, oh, it fell due to corrosion. It fell due to dents. Well, it didn't. Somebody did something wrong. A person did something wrong. You can't put a pipeline in prison. You know, lawyers are very right. They pick on the people. He did it. He's a bad corrosioner. He's a bad corrosioner. And same as Bellingham. Bellingham failure back in the 90s was people-based. It's down as a dent. It's not. It's people. So I think in many ways, learn to protect your pipeline, look after the pipeline, and you'll look after the people. It can't be the other way around.
In the early days, I remember Jerry, he told me once, he goes, the pipeline doesn't care where you put it. And his approach there was, it's part of risk. We have to understand the consequence of a failure happening. But at the end of the day, you're an engineer, and if you do your job and you keep it from failing, it doesn't matter if it's in an HCA or non-HCA.
Yeah, for sure. So, Phil, I just want to say, I don't want to go too deep on that. And the reason I don't is I was like, wow, I could say
something.
It's just a comment.
All right.
Phil, I want to say thank you for taking the time to join us. I sincerely hope that this is probably not the last time that we hear from you. To our audience, what I would really encourage you to do again is, if you get the chance at a JTM or a conference to run into Phil Hopkins and see him or hear him speak, take the opportunity. Go up and introduce yourself to him. It's like, you know, talking to one of the true OGs in the industry, and you'll probably get a really good witty comment out of it at the same time.
And Phil, so, I would say thank you for accepting and coming onto the podcast. Again, this podcast only exists because we continue to have guests, and we really, really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to do this. And one message to the audience, y'all heard it first here. Phil loves doing research for free. So y'all make sure y'all reach out to him and give him your best research idea.
Well, if you do things for free, you'll never be poor.
Yeah. All right. Well, to our guests, our audience, thanks for joining us. We will be back in a couple of weeks with our next episode. And this is Rhett and Chris signing off with our guest, Phil Hopkins. Thank you. This episode of Pipeline Things was executively produced by Sarah Etier, and I want to say thanks to my special co-host, Christopher DeLeon, and our guest, Dr. Phil Hopkins. Thanks for allowing us to shoot at Form Marketing's offices.